From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up on today's program, China detained several women's rights activists last week as open speech becomes less free. We have details in a moment on Daybreak Asia. Gender stereotypes and its connection to violence against women is investigated by Francis Alonzo on Women Rising. China's controversial actions in the South China Sea are the focus of Michael Lippin's report on China Focus. A Western diet can taste so good, but what is it doing for people's health? Ira Melman serves a hefty portion of the debate in the American Cafe, a new musical centered around the work of an impressionist artist. It made an impression on David Byrd in today's edition of Now. The music of Blossom Deary remembered. We'll also check business and sports, all coming up on today's edition of VOA Global. Hi, and welcome to Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asian news and events for Tuesday, March 10th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, several women's rights activists were detained in China over the last week. They are the latest targets in a widening crackdown on freedom of speech in the country. Speaking up is Shannon Van Sant, who has more on their arrests.
China arrested 10 women's rights activists in the lead-up to International Women's Day on Sunday. Five were released after questioning by police, and five are still in custody. The women still in detention include Li Tingting, Wei Tingting, Wang Mang, Zheng Churan, and Wu Rongrong. William Ni is a China researcher with Amnesty International and says the arrests are the latest sign of China's widening crackdown.
The important thing to know right now is that at Amnesty International, we're witnessing just an across-the-board crackdown on NGOs, civil society, especially the links between international agencies that fund human rights work. So it's within that context that this isn't, unfortunately, this isn't that surprising.
But although China has tightened restrictions on the work of many activists, academics, and journalists over the last year, the arrest of these women who were at the forefront of the women's rights movement has surprised observers like Ni.
However, I mean, I think that this type of move to detain women's rights activists on the eve of International Women's Day, women who are calling for the end to sexual harassment on public transportation, which is a well-known phenomenon in China, is just a really, really shocking.
The women had planned to put up leaflets and affix stickers to public transit vehicles as part of a nationwide campaign against sexual harassment on public transportation. Several of the women were affiliated with Yirenping, a nonprofit group that advocates equal rights for people with AIDS or disabilities. Their arrest came during an annual meeting of China's national parliament, when Beijing steps up security and police presence throughout the capital. Ni says that the arrests appear to be systematic and well-coordinated by the Chinese government, as the women were arrested in three cities in eastern China. Their release or continued detention will indicate the significance of the situation.
I think a lot will depend on whether or not they're released in the next day or two, to what extent this was related to the National People's Congress. The National People's Congress is usually a sensitive time in China where the government and local state security try to monitor activists and not allow for any sort of public disturbance. It's just another example, really, of the crackdown on civil society in China.
The arrest came as Chinese legislators reviewed the first national law against domestic violence during the National People's Congress. The new bill defines domestic violence for the first time. Nearly 40% of Chinese women who are married or in a relationship say they have suffered domestic abuse. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
China's monthly trade surplus soared in February to a record of more than $60 billion. Exports gained nearly 50% to more than $169 billion, while imports fell more than 20% to less than $109 billion. AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver in Sydney told VOA's Victor Beatty the ballooning Chinese trade surplus will likely serve as an irritant to some of China's trading partners, and it'll make it more difficult for Beijing to lower the value of its currency.
He said the export gain is tied to a rise in shipments ahead of the Lunar New Year, which was late this year, falling on February 19th.
That meant that in the case of exports, the export numbers a year ago were somewhat depressed. So when the headline number for exports says 48% growth, comparing February this year with February last year, that's coming off a pretty low base a year ago. So my feeling is that these numbers do exaggerate the strength we're seeing in Chinese exports. To get a better guide, the best thing to do is average the January and February results, and that suggests growth running at around 22%. Still very strong, but not the 48% number that the distorted February number alone would imply.
Well, Shane, imports continue to fall. Is that a sign of a weak Chinese economy?
The weak imports are a sign of a couple of things. One is we saw the collapse in commodity prices over the last 12 months. Big declines in, of course, the oil price, but also in the case of Australia, we saw a huge collapse in the price of coal and iron ore. And so these figures that come out of China, they're on an annual basis. And so the 20% odd decline that we've seen across January and February reflects that fall in commodity prices. But of course, when you dig beneath the surface, there's also weakness in underlying demand coming out of China, and that's largely one of the reasons why we've seen the commodity price fall in the first place. And, of course, that reflects softness in Chinese economic growth.
At the same time, Japan revised downward its fourth quarter growth in 2014 from 2.2% to 1.5%. Oliver says Tokyo shot itself in the foot with a sales tax hike last April and pushed the economy into two straight quarters of recession. He says while the world's number two and three economies are struggling, India, the United States, and Europe are doing surprisingly well. Manufacturing giant Hon-Hai Precision has long churned out iPads and iPhones with inexpensive labor in China. Now the global high-tech contractor plans to replace workers with potentially thousands of robots. The move has been applauded by both economists and even a normally critical labor rights group who says it would save Hon-Hai money to ease workplace disputes. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA from the company's home base, Taipei.
Taiwan's contract electronics maker Hon-Hai employs about 1 million workers at factories in China to make products for the world's top electronics brands. But company CEO Terry Guo told reporters last month Hon-Hai needs just 3 years to automate 70% of its product assembly. He says that shift would replace people with machines and improve efficiency. Jamie Wong, a principal research analyst with the market research firm Gartner in Taipei, calls automation a trend that Hon-Hai cannot ignore. She says the company must use robots to replace some of the manufacturing process, and that's understandable. She adds that Hon-Hai's major client, Apple, is planning to go in this direction, so they must make arrangements to meet client needs and for their own future labor costs. Over the next 10 to 20 years, Wong says companies cannot use manual labor to do manufacturing all the time. Hon-Hai's chairman had said in 2011 the company would replace some of its workers with 1 million robots. 2 years later, the company said it would spend $40 million on researching and manufacturing robotics in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. Hon-Hai, also known as Foxconn, faces stiffening competition for contract work as wages rise in China, a trend that has prompted many multinationals to expand production in Southeast Asia instead. Ralph Jennings for VOA News, Taipei.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. At voanews.com, you'll find longer versions of these stories, many with great photos and video. And don't forget to subscribe to our free Daybreak Asia podcast while you're there.
Time for us on VOA Global to sample what you've been saying about some of the stories that we've posted on our website at voanews.com. An Indian news channel ran a silent on-air protest late Sunday after the government banned the station from airing a BBC documentary about the brutal rape of a Delhi student in 2012. NDTV was scheduled to show India's Daughter late Sunday, but instead simply broadcast the title of the film in red and white against a black background, silently illuminated by a flickering oil lamp for the entire hour slot designated for the film. Joss from Australia writes, interesting article by Kavita Krishnan. Here's an excerpt. I am concerned at seeing responses on social media to the interviews vilifying Indian men as brutes. If solidarity with Indian struggles against misogyny and violence are overshadowed by racist profiling of Indian men, it is most disturbing. Another story we posted on our website, South Korean President Park Geun-hye on Monday visited hospitalized U.S. Ambassador Mark Lippert, who was slashed in a knife attack last week. Lord of the Flies from Japan says the historic bond between South Korea and the USA is as strong as the U.S.-Japan or even U.S.-Great Britain relationship. Unbreakable. Scientists in the Philippines are at work on a strain of rice that could solve one of the world's major health challenges, a vitamin A deficiency. The so-called golden rice, which has been genetically engineered to produce beta-carotene, has led to opposition from GMO opponents, including Greenpeace. Thomas Davies from London says, first, nothing has heated up. In fact, the article reports nothing new about the debate. Second, this technology is being bred and tested in the Philippines for possible release there. Even on their website, they say it's not yet ready. You can tell us your opinions at voanews.com. Jim Stevenson with you today on VOA Global. We've been asking for photos for our VOA Asia Facebook page from the recent Lunar New Year celebrations. If you've taken some great pictures during that time, send them to us. We'd love to see them. voaasia@voanews.com is our email address. We're going to go through all these pictures and pick out the one we like the best and put it right at the top of our Facebook page for everyone to see. Send us your photos.
Welcome to this edition of Voice of America's Women Rising. I'm your host, Frances Alonzo. The International Center for Research on Women and Plan International have released a report highlighting the gendered nature of violence and how violence is often exacerbated by gender stereotypes. Nandita Batla is a senior gender violence and rights specialist with ICRW in Asia. She tells me how what is considered normal childhood behaviors can be a gateway to disastrous behavior if left unchecked in childhood.
This is a survey that we actually took in 5 countries in Asia, and these countries were Pakistan, Cambodia, Vietnam, Nepal, and Indonesia.
So tell me about the gender-based violence. What's going on exactly there? Could you give us specifics?
Basically, we looked at 3 main forms of violence in which they are either being pushed around or they are being beaten up or they are being locked in toilets. Then you have other forms in which they are being called, you know, names. If it's got sexual overtones, that's sexual violence, past comments. In toilets, you have all kinds of visual abuse where being called stupid or being hit by teachers for not being able to complete work on time or coming late to school. And of course, we know the many, many forms of sexual violence that girls are facing from boys, from teachers.
You know, I'll be quite honest with you. Some of the things that you've described just seems like normal things growing up. Where does it cross the line into violence? I mean, you know, some teasing, you know, kids tease each other. But when does all of these behaviors cross the line?
Okay, so that's a very, I think, real question and a very difficult one, because one of the things that we realize working on violence is we often distinguish between teasing in which, you know, both parties are kind of equally saying something in the spirit of fun, and then there is teasing when you're actually making fun of someone. And the problem with all of those behaviors do, unfortunately, figure in the list of violence, because what we think is just growing up, we cannot justify one behavior at any point, because then everything about violence becomes conditional. Otherwise, what is okay for a person will not be okay for the other person. And it's very difficult to justify, or, you know, this behavior. I mean, I can just give a very real example about, you know, this boy who would constantly just pull girls' ribbons. And everyone said, oh, you know, this is what boys do all the time. But if you see 3-4 years down the line, that just pulling ribbons to tease just becomes a way of eve teasing, of sexual harassment along the lines.
If it's happening at school, it's happening at home, How do we address this issue? What's the answer then?
Yeah, the answer is the difficult answer that I think we've been trying to find through the program, where what we do is basically just let the person think on what you have actually done and what is your own behavior, you know?
Recognizing and thinking about it, but how does that get to stopping the behavior?
It's all about it being to break and institutions to set up some of these mechanisms to at least recognize and validate what the children say and say that it's not something that they want to tolerate in their schools or their families.
You have the results of the survey. What happens now? How is this used to help to change environments? You know, that's not quite an overnight thing. How is this used immediately? How can this help the situation?
This is the extent to which things are happening, and my child is seeing this in school and not being able to see something. Primary prevention of violence at younger ages and starting talking about gender and equality in, you know, institutions and at young ages is absolutely critical to try and do something about the gender-based violence we see later in life as such horrific manifestations.
That is Nandita Batla, the Senior Gender Violence and Rights Specialist with ICRW in Asia. You can read more about the survey titled Are Schools Safe and Equal Spaces for Girls and Boys in Asia at icrw.org. I'm Frances Alonso. Thank you for joining me on Women Rising.
This is China Focus on VOA Global. I'm Michael Lippin, filling in for Sarah Williams. China is defending its efforts to develop several reefs that it controls in the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. Satellite imagery released last month by Defense Intelligence Company IHS Jane's shows that Beijing significantly expanded reclamation work on the reefs in recent years, turning them into artificial islands. IHS Jane's said the islands appear to be military fortresses designed to enforce Chinese claims to the entire Spratly chain and almost all of the surrounding South China Sea. On Sunday, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said the construction is necessary, lawful, and does not target anyone. China has long faced criticism for such activities from other regional governments that also claim parts of the South China Sea. John Blaxland is a defense analyst at Australian National University. My colleague Victor Beattie asked him why China is brushing aside the criticism.
What I think China is trying to do is slowly but surely assert its claims over the South China Sea. It has for a long time, since 1947, when established the nine-dash line, they call it. It's been reasserted in recent years. And, of course, the nine-dash line goes against the basis of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea declares exclusive economic rights over the waters surrounding recognised territories above the high tide mark. If you start building additional features, the view is that you can, over time, legitimise your claims to sovereignty over the area. But China's view is interesting because it flies in the face of the UN Convention by claiming not just the waters surrounding the territories that have facilities and human habitation, but waters stretching beyond, virtually to the coastlines of the states abutting the South China Sea. And this is perhaps the most controversial aspect of it.
What do you make of Foreign Minister Wang's statement that his country has every right to carry out this construction and still is not changing its policy toward the region?
What the Chinese authorities are saying needs to be seen in the context of what's happening globally. Russia has been very effective at playing a game of subterfuge over Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and the Chinese have watched intently and have seen how little the West has done in response. There is therefore a view, I believe, developing in Beijing whereby China feels that it is in a similar predicament in terms of its ability to act in a more restrained way than Russia, admittedly, but act without fear of retribution in pursuit of its claims in the South China Sea. And one of the reasons why it is confident in doing so is because it knows that the territorial claims of the other claimants in the South China Sea are all on legally fraught ground. They know that their claims are contentious and hard to substantiate. And therefore, if they work on the principle that possession is nine-tenths of the law, if you possess enough of it, then eventually you will win. The Chinese don't feel the need to rush on this, but they do feel that there is a window of opportunity now, knowing that no one in the area has any appetite to challenge them effectively. The United States has made it very clear to countries like the Philippines that its provisions, its treaty provisions over the Philippines do not apply over the contested claims in the South China Sea. But interestingly, while ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, has in recent months declared a stronger joint purpose for their view on how the South China Sea should be treated, the bottom line is that there is a schism within ASEAN between the claimant states and the non-claimant states, the non-claimant states being the mainland, essentially Theravada Buddhist states of Laos, Cambodia, Thailand and Myanmar, versus the other states, particularly the maritime states that do have a claim. So ASEAN is in a very difficult position, and China knows this, and China is happy to play off this with carrots and sticks, if you like, with incentives and disincentives for the various states to act against China's wishes.
That was John Blaxland of Australian National University speaking with Victor Beattie. And that's China Focus. I'm Michael Lippin.
On the Voice of America, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. Hong Kong shares finished mixed Monday after the Chinese securities regulator said banks may be able to enter the brokerage business. Despite the bank-led rally that left both major mainland indices up over 1.5%, Hong Kong's Hang Seng index ended slightly lower. It fell 0.2% to close at 24,123, while the China Enterprises Index gained 0.6% to finish at 11,675. A strengthening U.S. recovery is helping to underpin China's outlook as Asia's biggest economy seeks to cut excess capacity and transition to reliance on domestic consumption rather than debt-fueled infrastructure spending. China's exports surged more than 48% in February from a year earlier. That exceeded the median analyst forecast for a 14% jump, led by sales to the United States and Europe. While that number was skewed by distortions from the timing of the Lunar New Year holiday, the combined figure with January still showed overseas sales rose 15%. The government is targeting a 6% gain in trade for 2015. China should not roll out a big stimulus measure to spur the slowing economy, and the government cannot rely too heavily on monetary policy. That's according to a central bank policy advisor on Monday. Xian Yingyi, a member of the central bank's monetary policy committee, said during the annual meeting of the country's parliament that the use of short-term stimulus could exacerbate distortions in the economy. The Reserve Bank of India will lower interest rates further over the coming year, but only gradually. Wary that a subdued inflation may be picking up again, according to economists polled by Reuters. That's a look at Asia Business News on the Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On March 10th, 241 BC, the first of three conflicts between Rome and Carthage was decided in a naval battle off the west coast of Sicily. The Roman fleet scored a victory, leading to a Carthaginian surrender in the first of the so-called Punic Wars. On this date in 1804, the American flag was raised on day two of the Three Flags ceremony in St. Louis. This happened after the French and Spanish flags had been lowered. The ceremony marked the turning over of the Louisiana Purchase, more than 2 million square kilometers of territory, to the United States. In 1831, the French Foreign Legion was created. The Legion was an all-volunteer force that once attracted mostly foreigners, troublemakers, and outcasts. Commanded by French officers, the Legion has seen combat in regional and world wars. In 1848, the U.S. Senate ratified the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, ending the three-year war between the United States and Mexico. With the defeat of its army and the fall of its capital, Mexico ceded territory, now covering some or all of the U.S. states of Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. In 1906, Europe's worst mining accident occurred in northern France. A coal dust explosion took the lives of more than 1,000 men. On this day in 1910, slavery was officially abolished in China. On this day in 1913, abolitionist Harriet Tubman died. Over the course of 10 years, Tubman, a runaway slave, would lead hundreds of other slaves to freedom along the so-called Underground Railroad, a secret network of safe houses. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Just ahead, U.S. President Obama accuses his Republican opponents of siding with Iranian hardliners. The United Nations says poor sanitation is the main culprit in southern Africa's latest cholera outbreak. And we'll preview the Indian Prime Minister's regional tour of Indian Ocean nations. I'm Michael Lippin. U.S. President Barack Obama is criticizing a group of 47 Republican senators who have warned Iran that any nuclear deal it negotiates with Mr. Obama could last only until he leaves office in early 2017. In the letter to Iran issued by the senators on Monday, they said that any deal it signs with the United States and five other world powers would be considered by Congress as nothing more than an executive agreement between Tehran and Mr. Obama, unless U.S. lawmakers also approve it. Mr. Obama ridiculed that warning when he spoke to reporters later at the White House.
Well, I think it's somewhat ironic to see some members of Congress wanting to make common cause with the hardliners in Iran. It's an unusual coalition. I think what we're going to focus on right now is actually seeing whether we can get a deal or not. And once we do, then we'll... If we do, then we'll be able to make the case to the American people, and I'm confident we'll be able to implement it.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also criticized the Republicans' letter, saying it has no legal value and is mostly a propaganda ploy. Zarif said that if the next U.S. president revokes any agreement with Iran, he or she will be committing a blatant violation of international law. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition battling Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq says it carried out 13 airstrikes against the group on Monday, focusing largely on the towns of Kobani and Fallujah. The Pentagon spokesman also said that the United States and its partners have carried out almost 2,800 airstrikes on Islamic State targets since the beginning of the campaign in August. A VOA Kurdish service reporter, Dilshad Anwar, saw evidence of heavy airstrikes in northern Iraq's Kirkuk area, which U.S. defense officials said was hit twice by the coalition in the last day. Soldiers from Chad and Niger have retaken the northeastern Nigerian town of Damasak from Boko Haram Islamist militants. The capture of the Nigerian town on the Niger-Nigeria border is the first reported success of a joint offensive by Chad and Niger against the militants in Nigeria's Borno state in recent days. Chadian sources say about 10 Chadian soldiers were killed and 20 others were wounded in fighting to free the Nigerian town. Various sources also said at least 200 Boko Haram fighters were killed, but there was no independent confirmation of that figure. Speaking to VOA on Monday, a Nigerian military spokesman indicated that the cross-border offensive by Chad and Niger has Nigeria's support. The United Nations says cholera is spreading again in southern Africa, infecting almost 6,000 people in Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, and killing 45. The disease is caused by contact with polluted water and causes diarrhea, vomiting, and severe dehydration. It can kill within hours if not properly treated. Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
The United Nations Coordination Agency, OCHA, says Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe have seen nearly 6,000 cholera cases since January. Johannesburg-based OCHA reporting officer Heinz Zeeley traced the chronology of the outbreak.
What we're seeing now is a very big outbreak in northern Mozambique that spilled over into southern Malawi, which is also dealing with a very severe flooding situation. And now we also have cases starting to be reported in Zimbabwe, which is of great concern, as that was the country that was most affected during the 2008-2009 outbreak that killed over 4,000 people.
The outbreak is hardly breaking news, says Dewa Mavenga, a senior Southern Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch.
So what is happening now is really quite sad and embarrassing for the government of Zimbabwe. It shows a lack of preparedness. It shows a lack of prioritization in terms of putting sufficient resources towards the health and sanitation in the country.
Zili says the heavy rains do provoke seasonal outbreaks of cholera in this region. The African continent usually reports the bulk of the world's cholera cases. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
U.S. President Barack Obama has ordered new sanctions against seven senior Venezuelan officials who the United States says violated human rights and engaged in public acts of corruption. Targets in the U.S. executive order announced on Monday include the head of Venezuela's intelligence service, as well as the director of the National Police. The statement called on the Venezuelan government to release all political prisoners, including dozens of students, opposition leader Leopoldo López, and mayors Daniel Ceballos of San Cristobal and Antonio Ledezma of Caracas. The U.S. executive order comes as tensions between the U.S. and Venezuela intensify. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is starting a tour of three small neighboring Indian Ocean nations on Tuesday as he seeks to ramp up New Delhi's influence along a strategic maritime route where China's presence has been growing. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the Indian Prime Minister will focus on bolstering security ties in the region.
The first stop for Prime Minister Modi will be Seychelles. From there, he travels on to Mauritius and Sri Lanka. These are tiny island countries, but they are receiving priority treatment. Mr. Modi will be the first Indian Prime Minister to travel to Seychelles in 33 years and to Sri Lanka in 28 years. Indian Foreign Secretary Subramaniam Jaishankar says New Delhi wants to tap on the substantive goodwill for India in these countries.
We are looking at our visit, our interests, the possibilities of our cooperation with these countries. And we are very bullish about where we see these relationships going.
Besides strengthening economic links, Mr. Modi will focus on boosting maritime ties as India seeks to become the main security provider in the Indian Ocean region. That's partly to offset China's security cooperation with these countries, which has raised worries in New Delhi about Beijing's push into the Indian Ocean region. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
A solar-powered Swiss airplane has landed in Oman after completing the first leg of its round-the-world journey without any fuel. The plane touched down in Muscat on Monday, about 10 hours after it took off from Abu Dhabi. The carbon-fiber single-seater Solar Impulse 2 aircraft has a 72-meter wingspan, which is longer than the wingspan of a Boeing 747, and it weighs about as much as a car. The 17,000 solar cells built into the wings harness the sun's energy, allowing it to fly through the night. Well, that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin. We'll see you next time.
This is Business News on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. U.S. stocks bounced back Monday, helped by a couple of billion-dollar deals, while Apple shares ended slightly higher after the long-anticipated unveiling of its new watch. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 136 points to close at 17,993. The S&P 500 also up just a little over 8 points, or 0.39%, to finish at 2079. The NASDAQ composite added 15 points to close at 4942. You can make calls, read email, control music, manage Instagram photos, keep up with your workout, pay for groceries, open your hotel room door. All of that, CEO Tim Cook says, is possible from your wrist with the new Apple Watch. For about 18 hours a day, that's how long the battery will last on the average day. The other 6 hours are up to you. Pre-orders start on April the 10th. The device costs $349 for a base model. A luxury gold version will also be available if you have $10,000 to spare. Industry watchers are eager to see if Apple's version will be the tipping point for the sluggish smartwatch market. There was similar skepticism when Apple released the iPad back in 2010, yet the company has successfully sold millions, and its popularity has shaken up the PC market. The dollar fell from an 11.5-year high versus the euro on Monday as investors took profits from gains made after last week's strong U.S. employment report that helped to cement expectations the Federal Reserve will be raising U.S. interest rates later this year. The euro held up at $1.8540, up 0.7%. That's a look at business news on the Voice of America. World's biggest dog show now has a murder mystery on its hands. A champion Irish setter died after its owner said it had been fed steak laced with poison. The death of 3-year-old Jagger rocked Britain's Crufts show, held annually since the reign of Queen Victoria. Some British newspapers have speculated he might have been the victim of mistaken identity, as his half-brother Pot Noodle is also another successful show dog. A Scottish terrier from Russia won Best in Show.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Many people in the United States make New Year resolutions. Many of those promises to themselves deal with losing weight. On a wider scale, the globalization of Western eating habits is bad for human health and for the environment. That according to a study in the journal Nature. Dietary solutions to this diet, health, environment trilemma do exist, but as VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports, they'll require a change in eating habits that are heavily influenced by culture, taste, price, and convenience.
In the study, David Tillman analyzed data from 100 countries to chart what people ate and how diet affected health. The University of Minnesota ecology professor noted a trend beginning in the 1960s as nations industrialized, populations increased, and incomes rose. More people began to adopt the so-called Western diet, one high in refined sugar, fat, oil, and meat. People began to get fatter and sicker.
The excess, let's say, in the 15 richest nations in the world right now is on the order of about 400 or 500 extra calories a day that are eaten beyond what people need, and that leads to people to gain weight.
And overweight people are at greater risk for non-communicable diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and some cancers.
Diabetes is shooting at a very high rate in the United States and across Europe. Heart disease is a major cause of mortality in the Western countries. And unfortunately, when people become industrialized, if they adopt this Western diet, they're going to have these same health impacts. And in some cases, if you're Asian, actually have them more severely than even happens in the West.
China, he says, is a case in point where diabetes has skyrocketed.
From less than 1% to 10% of the population having diabetes as they began to industrialize over a 20-year period. And that hasn't leveled off yet. That's still going up. So, and that is happening all across the world, in Mexico and Nigeria and so on, just nation after nation.
And the diet bad for humans is also bad for the environment. As global population grows, experts say more forests and tropical habitats will be converted into farmland for crops or grazing pasture for cattle to meet the increased demand for food.
We're likely to have more greenhouse gas released in the future from agriculture because of this dietary shift than all the greenhouse gas that right now comes out of all of the cars and all the airplanes, boats, and ships, all forms of transportation. So our change in diet is likely to be worse for the world for climate warming than all the transportation sources we use right now.
Writing in the journal Nature, Tillman says the link between diet, the environment, and human health, what he calls a trilemma, is one of the greatest challenges facing humanity. One solution he presents is leaving the Western diet behind, something that Jacqueline Rogers and Mike Richmond know something about. The two VOA staffers have each lost 22 kilograms and kept off the weight. Rogers, who has a family history of diabetes, calls herself a reformed carboholic.
I ate lots of carbs all the time. That was my go-to. Pastas, rices, potatoes, breads. I never met any of those things in any form that I didn't like. I had to switch that around, become more vegetable-based, more fruit-based, more protein-based.
Richmond says he was always athletic, but could not compete like he used to because he was overweight. He started to go to a gym, lift weights, and run on a treadmill. At the same time, he changed his diet.
And I've just cut out a lot of sweets,
a lot of junk, and also just simple things like walking up the stairs and instead of taking the elevator. I always do that. I will not take the elevator at all.
So how do you feel now?
I feel great.
I feel fantastic. I feel much better. I feel alive. I'm not sluggish. I feel like I can do anything I set my mind to.
Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Your reservation has been made. Join us in the cafe every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. This is David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Impressionist artist Edgar Degas' famous statue, Little Dancer, Aged 14, is the subject of a new musical here in Washington at the Kennedy Center. The statue, one of Degas' last works before he lost his sight, caused a commotion when it was first exhibited in Paris in 1881. The artist sculptured the statue out of wax, gave it real human hair and a real tutu and slippers. But it has also become one of his most famous works. Allison Lukes is the acting head of sculpture and decorative arts at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. She told the Associated Press that visitors there have a unique chance to see the original statue.
The statuette is the only work of sculpture that Degas ever exhibited in his whole lifetime. And it's also the original version of a very famous statuette, famous because after Degas' death, it was replicated at his family's wishes in beautiful bronze casts, more than 30 of them. And those can be seen in museums all over the world today and in private collections. But the original, the only one Degas ever touched or saw, is the one that's here in this room.
The actual dancer portrayed was Marie van Gutham, a Belgian-born girl trying to make it in the Paris Opera in the late 1800s. Allison Lukes says that the statuette offers viewers a glimpse of a young girl on the verge of womanhood who is determined to succeed.
We see her at the age of 14, and Degas carefully included her age in the title of the sculpture. He didn't give his paintings and drawings and sculptures titles at all. This one, it really mattered to him to tell you that she was 14, meaning that she was at the beginning. She was on the brink. She could go either way.
The $7 million Kennedy Center musical looks at Marie and Degas' relationship during this time. Parts of the musical story are based on writings left by the artist and American artist Mary Cassatt, who collaborated with Degas in Paris. Susan Stroman is the show's choreographer and director.
She came from a very poor family, but wanted to become a ballerina. And Degas really sort of became obsessed drawing her and painting her. You see her face in many of his pictures and paintings. So it was really, the idea was to bring her back to life.
Stroman is known for her works on the Broadway productions of Contact, The Music Man, and The Producers. New York City Ballet principal dancer Tyler Peck plays Marie. Peck told the AP that she believes that Marie was a match for the artist in every respect.
I just feel like they love to bicker, Degas and Marie. You know, they're like, he's finally met a ballerina who isn't afraid to speak. And I think that that's what's really special about her, is that she's not scared of him and she's not afraid to speak her mind, when normally ballerinas, you know, you don't think they speak.
Marie van Gutham was dismissed from the Paris Opera in 1882, and she disappeared from the historical records. The show hints at several paths that her life could have taken. Susan Stroman says that the musical also shows the difficulties that women faced in the French capital in the late 1800s.
It's a serious story because it does touch on the plight of women in Paris in 1881 and what their options were. So it does have a very serious tone to it. Yet within that, it has the joy of dance.
The musical is a unique combination. It's about a statue that was inspired by the ballet. Multiple Tony Award winner Boyd Gaines plays Degas. The musical Little Dancer plays at Washington's Kennedy Center through November. The statuette, Little Dancer, Aged 14, remains on display at Washington's National Gallery of Art. So, what do you think? Are you a fan of the Impressionists? Have you ever seen Little Dancer, aged 14? Do you have a favorite sculpture or painting by Edgar Degas or another artist? Let us know your thoughts and ask your questions on our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email us your thoughts by addressing them to voaasia@voanews.com. That's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Thief or hero, a carpenter has been fired for freeing a raccoon that had been trapped by exterminators at the San Francisco construction site where he worked. The builders blamed it for damage at the $610 million project. 49-year-old Todd Sutton took the animal, released it after getting guidance from animal control officers, but his employer said it was theft because he took something that didn't belong to him. It's sports time on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. As cycling deals with a scathing report into its deep-rooted culture of doping, UCI President Brian Cookson said Monday that cheating remains endemic in the sport, but the governing body will no longer turn a blind eye to the problem. Cookson also said he wants former UCI leader Hein Verbruggen to give up his honorary presidency after the 227-page dossier said the governing body colluded with Lance Armstrong to cover up positive tests at the 1999 Tour de France. The International Cycling Union was severely criticized in the report for failing to act during the doping era dominated by Armstrong and broke rules to favor the now disgraced rider. The report was commissioned by the new UCI leadership to investigate doping that shredded cycling's credibility and led to Armstrong being stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles in 2012. Kentucky's season-long run at number 1 in the Associated Press Top 25 of U.S. college basketball keeps right on going. The Wildcats, now 31-0, received all 65 votes from a media panel Monday after completing the first undefeated regular season in school history. Kentucky can become the first team since UNLV in 1990 and 91 to be number 1 for the entire season in next week's final poll. Duke moved up to number 2 ahead of Virginia, which dropped a spot after losing to Louisville. Number 10, Northern Iowa, is back in the top 10 after winning the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament. Wichita State dropped 4 spots to number 12 after losing in the Valley semifinals to Illinois State. Number 25, Boise State, ranked for the first time. And number 24, Davidson, is back for the first time since 2008. Get ready to fill out those brackets. New York Jets running back Chris Johnson and another passenger were shot in their shoulders while stopped at a traffic light in Orlando, Florida, early Sunday. The driver of that vehicle they were in was killed. The NFL player and the other passenger, Reggie Johnson, were in stable condition at the hospital. A person close to Johnson confirmed it was the running back who was involved. Sheriff's deputies said another vehicle pulled up to the Jeep. The men were in, opened fire. No arrests have been made. Investigators are on the scene. That's sports.
Almost any day for me is a blossom kind of day. Blossom deary, that is.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Born Marguerite Blossom Deary in 1924, she was an American jazz singer and pianist, known for her light and girlish voice. Deary, who moved to Paris in 1952 as her career took off, died in 2009. She's remembered even today in France. A recent tribute featured this appearance on French television in 1965.
Hello, my name is Blossom Deary. This is my second trip to Paris. The first time I came over here, I worked with Jack. We did a television show and a few radio shows. And this time I'm working at a charming little club called Le Quatre Vents, and I hope that you all come to hear me. I wish you bluebirds in the spring to give your heart a song to sing.
and then a kiss. But more than this, I wish you love. And in July, a lemonade to cool you in some leafy glade. I wish you health and more than wealth. I wish you love. My aching heart and I agree that you and I could never be. So with my best, my very best, I set you free. I wish you shelter from the storm, a cozy fire to keep you warm. But most of all, when snowflakes fall, I wish you love.
Blossom Deary worked with many of the great songwriters of recent times, including Johnny Mercer and Alan J. Lerner. In 1974, she formed her own record label, Daffodil Records, which allowed her to have full control of the recording and distribution of her albums. One of Blossom's most popular songs was written by Arthur Schwartz. Rhode Island Is Famous for You takes the listener on a trip around the U.S.
Copper comes from Arizona, peaches come from Georgia, and lobsters come from Maine. The wheat fields are the sweet fields of Nebraska, and Kansas gets bonanzas from the grain. Old whiskey comes from old Kentucky, ain't the country lucky? New Jersey gives us glue. And you come from Rhode Island, and little old Rhode Island is famous for you. Cotton comes from Louisiana, gophers from Montana, and spuds from Idaho. They plow land in the cowland of Missouri, where most beef meant for roast beef seems to grow. Grand Canyons come from Colorado, gold comes from Nevada, divorces also do. And you come from Rhode Island, little old Rhode Island is famous for you. Pencils come from Pennsylvania, vests from West Virginia, and tents from Tennessee. They know mink where they grow mink in Wyoming.
That's music on VOA Global. I'm Steve Norman.
And minnows come from Minnesota, coats come from Dakota. But why should you be blue? For you come from Rhode Island. Don't let them ride Rhode Island. It's famous for you.
If you're with us for yesterday's program, you may have heard me tell you about a giant octopus that was in an aquarium in Washington State. Today, it's an endangered 500-pound leatherback sea turtle. Detective theme here. It's being treated at a South Carolina aquarium Monday after wildlife officials made a rare rescue of the reptile found alive and stranded on a remote beach. It is the first living leatherback turtle to be recovered in South Carolina and only one of a handful ever treated at rehab facilities in the United States. That, according to Jenna Cormany, a wildlife biologist with the state's Department of Natural Resources. State wildlife officials spotted the animal on Saturday on the beach on Yawkey South Island Reserve. It's about a 5.6-kilometer-long barrier island and wildlife preserve near Georgetown, South Carolina. The thing was so big, it took five people nearly 4 hours to retrieve the turtle from the beach. The animal was then driven an hour and a half to Charleston, South Carolina. The leatherbacks are the largest turtle in the world, the only sea turtles without a hard shell. Those things can get pretty heavy, up to 2,000 pounds or 900 kilograms as adults, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Wildlife officials think this turtle they found is a young female that may have eaten some debris, shell, or a plastic bag mistaken for a jellyfish. They hope to send it back out into the wild because they do poorly in captivity. We're releasing ourselves out to the wild. It's time for us to close our program. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zeynep Abdelrahman, and we do have a managing editor. Her name is Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. You can join us right back here again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.